This is the Berkeley Signal.
The Venezuelan government is accusing the United States of staging a coup after Trump announced the U.S. would recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's new leader. Trump made the announcement shortly after Guaido, the new head of Venezuela's National Assembly, declared himself president during a large opposition protest. In September, the New York Times reported the Trump administration conducted secret meetings with rebellious military officers in Venezuela to discuss overthrowing Maduro. In August, Maduro survived an assassination attempt when he was attacked by a small drone. He accused the U.S. and Colombia of being involved in the plot. All of this comes as Venezuela is facing a staggering economic crisis caused in part by falling oil prices and broad U.S. sanctions. According to the IMF, inflation is over 1,000,000% in the last year, the highest rate in the world. There are widespread reports of food and medicine shortages. The United Nations estimates 3 million Venezuelans have left Venezuela since 2015, resulting in what the UN has described as an unprecedented migration crisis in Latin America. We're joined now by two guests. In Claremont, California, Miguel Tinker-Salas, professor at Pomona College. And in Geneva, Switzerland, we're joined by Alfred de Zayas, former UN independent expert who visited Venezuela in 2017. He's professor of law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Miguel Tinker-Salas, let's begin with you as a Venezuelan, as a professor here in the United States. Can you talk about what just has transpired? The United States recognizing a new president of Venezuela, not elected. He declared himself this in the streets. And Venezuela now saying they are cutting off ties with the United States.
This is unprecedented, not only in Venezuelan history, but in Latin America. The only similarity as a historian that I can recall was with the Bay of Pigs, in which part of the U.S. plan in landing troops in Cuba was to declare a government in exile, and then that government in exile, up in arms, would request U.S. military assistance, and the U.S. would then land troops. This is a scenario that likely could play out in Venezuela. It depends on what Guaido decides to do. There is no way that Maduro can accept another sovereign, another person declaring to be president within the country. So this is an effort to escalate the crisis, to polarize the conditions further. It is the equivalent, essentially, of Nancy Pelosi saying that Donald Trump is a usurper, he is corrupt, he has laid off 800,000 federal employees, and I'm going to declare myself president of the U.S., and she would be recognized by France, Germany, and England. It's unprecedented. And again, I don't see how it resolves any of the fundamental problems that exist in Venezuela. It doesn't address the economic issues. It doesn't address the social issues, and simply closes the door to dialogue, to negotiations, which I think are the only solution possible in Venezuela. The reality is Donald Trump has no experience with Latin America. He can sit there and coddle dictators in Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's calling for elections in Venezuela when his own elections were corrupt and even from the perspective of U.S. observers were largely illegal, with Jimmy Morales in Guatemala, a president who's separates families and their children at the border, a president who will not even consider asylum claims by Latin Americans who are fleeing conditions created in part by U.S. policy in Central America. The reality is that this is a politically driven agenda, largely by Miami elites, by Marco Rubio, by Mike Pompeo, by John Bolton in November, with the declaration of a wish to eliminate what they call the Troika of Tyranny. It was clear that they were going to go after Venezuela, after Cuba, and after Nicaragua. And this is now the realization. It's no coincidence that this all happened yesterday. Yesterday was the anniversary of the ouster of dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez on January 23rd, 1958. So this was very much of an orchestrated event. We saw the buildup for it in the weeks before that with Guaido's declaration, Trump's recognition, then the Lima group, which had already made a declaration earlier. I should point out that Mexico and Uruguay are not a part of it, and Mexico and Uruguay have offered to negotiate to provide the context for dialogue in Latin America, as has Spain and Portugal. So I think it's important to understand that there are alternative voices out there that recognize that what is happening is an infringement on sovereignty and on the independence of Venezuela, and is against the UN Charter, against the OAS, and against international treaties, where, again, countries do not meddle in the internal affairs of other countries.
And yet the OAS has recognized Guaido as the new president.
Well, we should understand this is Mr. Almagro, who as head of the OAS has made the greatest effort to try to have regime change in Venezuela. And the reason why the Lima group was created is they couldn't get the OAS to condemn the government of Venezuela, so that the conservative governments within the OAS created the Lima group as a pressure against the government of Venezuela. What we're talking about is intervention. And there's a long history of intervention in Venezuela. It starts with the discovery of oil in 1922, when there was a symbiotic relationship between the oil industry in Venezuela and the U.S. government and the U.S. society and the U.S. economy. In many ways, the progression of oil industry and oil linked the two countries together. It also meant that the U.S. engaged in a fundamental nation-building project in Venezuela, trying to create institutions that would be similar to the U.S. and that would favor U.S. foreign investments and the repatriation of profits. The only country in Latin America America by the 1940s that allowed for foreign capital. But when Venezuela became an exporter of oil, it also became a net importer of food. It created a tremendous dependence. But the greatest intervention of the U.S. has been the sale of the American way of life, of the consumer value, of the notion that Venezuela was an exceptional country. And it created this dependence to the U.S., to the oil industry, that is now fracturing the country, because much of that dependence is to blame for the lack of other economic development in the country, along with government mismanagement, improvisation, and of course, U.S. sanctions, which have worsened conditions in Venezuela because it impedes the country from access to credit, from being able to renegotiate its debt. Part of that intervention is multifaceted.
Are you concerned that at this point, with President Maduro kicking out the U.S. from Venezuela, saying within 72 hours, and now the U.S. saying, no, they won't go, that the U.S. is setting Maduro up for some kind of situation that will lead to U.S. intervention?
There's no doubt that this is a tactical pincer movement in which they're trying to corner Maduro. They know that he has to respond in some way. If he doesn't respond, he loses support among his own base. He loses credibility. He loses legitimacy. So in that sense, they know that they can manipulate. Pompeo has already announced that the U.S. diplomats will not leave. If that's the case, then it sets up a situation for a crisis that's reminiscent of Grenada, when the U.S. utilized the medical students in Grenada against the government of Maurice Bishop, who had been killed, as a pretext for an invasion. That's always the threat. That's always the challenge. Remembering what Trump said, that all options are on the table, so that there is that concern. Again, that would lead to bloodshed, that would lead to destabilization, and that would be the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, again, is for cooler heads to prevail, for dialogue, negotiations, for the Vatican, for Mexico and Uruguay to provide the context for a dialogue in Venezuela that would lead to some sort of peaceful transformation and peaceful solution.
We continue to talk about the situation in Venezuela. We're joined by Alfred de Zayas in Geneva. Welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about what we are seeing right now in Venezuela. Are we seeing a coup d'etat unfolding?
As far as a coup d'etat, well, it is not a consummated coup d'etat. It is an attempted coup d'etat. Now, we all believe in democracy. Now, there's nothing more undemocratic than a coup d'etat. And also boycotting elections. As you know, there have been 26, 27 elections in Venezuela since Chavez was elected in 1998. So if you want to play the game, you have to participate in the elections. And if the opposition refused to participate in the elections, they bear responsibility for the situation that has ensued. Beyond that, I want to endorse the words of my Secretary General Guterres, who has called for dialogue. I very much supported the mediation carried out in 2016-2018 by José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, the former Spanish Prime Minister, and that actually would have led to a sensible compromise. The text was on the table, was ready for signature. At the last moment, Julio Borges refused to sign it. Now, is it a coup d'etat? Well, this is a matter of semantics. We have here an unconstitutional situation in which the legislature is usurping competences that belong to the executive and to the judiciary. The judiciary has already declared all of these actions and declarations of the National Assembly to be unconstitutional. Now, I am not a constitutional lawyer in Venezuela, but I did have the opportunity when I was in Venezuela in November, December 2017 to speak with all stakeholders, with members of the National Assembly, of the Chamber of Commerce, of the universities, students, opposition leaders, opposition NGOs, Provea, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the OAS representative there, etc., and of course with all the ministers. Now, the function of a rapporteur is not to go around grandstanding. The function of the rapporteur is not naming and shaming. The function of a rapporteur is to listen and then to study all the relevant documentation and arrive at constructive proposals, which I formulated in my report, which was presented to the Human Rights Council last September 10, 2018. Now, I formulated many recommendations, and actually the government already implemented some of my recommendations even shortly after my visit, because I also gave the foreign minister of Venezuela, Mr. Arreaza, a six-page confidential memorandum upon my departure. Some of that was reflected then in my report. But my concern, and I think it is a concern of every person who believes in democracy and in the rule of law, is to calm the waters. My concern is to avoid a civil war. One thing that I told to members of the opposition is that you simply cannot topple the government, and Maduro is not simply going to roll over. There are 7, 8, 9 million Venezuelans who are committed Chavistas, and you have to take them into account. What are you going to do with them if you topple the government through a coup d'etat? What are you going to do with these people? These people are most likely going to fight. Now, we don't want fighting. We don't want shedding of blood. Therefore, the only logical avenue now is to call for dialogue, and I hope that the Vatican and Mexico and Uruguay will lead the way.
What about the role of the media in what is happening right now in Venezuela? You would have no idea the level of involvement of the United States, right through to this video that Vice President Pence posted right before Juan Guaido announced from the streets that he was the president.
Mainstream media has been complicit in this attempted coup. Mainstream media has prepared, through a conundrum of fake news, an atmosphere that the public should accept this regime change imposed by the United States on the people of Venezuela, because ultimately it's supposed to be for the good of the Venezuelans. Now, this reminds us of the run-up to the Iraq invasion of 2003. Mainstream media supported all the lies, all the manipulations of George W. Bush and Tony Blair to convince the world that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And on this excuse, it was made somewhat palatable to world public opinion that you would enter Iraq and change the government by force. Now, the fact is that here you had not only a crime of aggression, not only an illegal war, as the late Secretary General Kofi Annan in more than one occasion stated. Here you have actually a revolt of 43 states, the coalition of the willing, against international law. If there is one tenet of the UN Charter that is jus cogens, that is peremptory international law, is the prohibition of the use of force. And this attack on Iraq was conducted by 43 states in collusion, breaking all the rules of international law. Now, that was preceded by this media campaign. Now, we have had for the last years, actually, a media campaign against Venezuela. And I'm particularly familiar with it because before I went to Venezuela, I had to read everything and all the reports, not only of the Washington Post and of the New York Times, but also the reports of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the reports of Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, etc., proposing that there was a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. Now, when I went to Venezuela, I again took the opportunity to interview representatives of Amnesty International and Provea and the other opposition NGOs, but I also had the opportunity to study the documents, to compare, to see the statistics, etc., etc. And of course, there was no humanitarian crisis. There was hunger. There was what we say in Spanish, zozobra. There was suffering. There was malnutrition, etc., etc. But it's not just stating that there is an economic crisis. That's not the crucial point. The crucial point is, which are the causes of that so-called humanitarian crisis? And certainly those who are crying humanitarian crisis should be the least to say that they should now solve the problem. There's a principle of international law called ex injuria non oritur ius, which is the principle of estoppel. So they should be stopped from demanding regime change when they themselves are the ones who are aggravating a situation caused initially by the dramatic fall of oil prices.
I'm going to give Miguel Tinker Salas the last word here. What you expect to see? I mean, what we've seen in the past, before President Chavez, there was almost a coup against him. The military took him. He got free. Same happened in Ecuador with Correa. But he also was able to free himself and continue as president. On the other hand, you had President Aristide in Haiti, a proven U.S. links there to the coup. He was flown out. And you had President Zelaya in Honduras. He also was forced out of his position. He did not succeed in maintaining power. What do you think will happen here, Professor Tinker Salas?
I think part of what the U.S. is trying to do, and the opposition, is to see if there are fundamental cracks within the military that would facilitate their strategy. That, again, would lead to a coup d'etat. That, I think, would not be the best outcome for Venezuela. I insist, if we continue to ratchet up this brinksmanship, we run the risk of exacerbating this crisis and of seeing violence. And I think we should try to avoid the violence. I think the best case solution is to find some process by which negotiations and discussions can take place. We can have cooler heads prevail and begin to have a conversation in which we recognize the presence of the other. Because if there are elections tomorrow, and if the government wins, the opposition will not recognize. If the opposition wins, the Chavista supporters will not recognize. That's a stalemate. We have to be able to break those loggerheads and find solutions in which long-term Venezuelans come to term with the presence of the other in society and recognize the humanity of the other and find dialogue and a peaceful solution to this crisis.
did. Oh, 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 no. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Michel Chosadovsky, welcome again.
Delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
President Trump's surprise announcement that the U.S. is leaving Syria caught most people in and out of government by surprise and led to the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis. 2,000 U.S. troops will be withdrawn from Syria. What is your assessment of this move?
Well, first of all, that withdrawal is, in terms of U.S. forces, is trivial. The United States has operated in Syria by financing and supporting tens of thousands of jihadists with the support of Saudi Arabia and up to a certain point also Turkey, although Turkey has a different agenda. And within those jihadist forces, you have covert special forces from a number of Western countries. I don't view this necessarily as a major shift in the U.S. foreign policy, but it's also the result of the fact that the Russians are playing a key role. Turkey is playing its own role with a tacit alliance with Russia and Iran. And I think that what now the United States is doing is not a retreat necessarily. It's a strategic withdrawal with a view of eventually that its allies, particularly Saudi Arabia, Israel, might play a more active role. And we see that Israel is actually involved in routine bombings of Syria.
Well, you have long maintained that Israel's defense forces are integrated into the U.S. military command structure and as such do not act alone. Does this then mean that when the Israeli Air Force strikes Syria, as was done over Christmas, that the U.S. has signed off on these attacks?
Well, you know, if you look at the structure of military alliances and the agreements reached both with NATO as well as with the Pentagon, Israel is a de facto member of NATO, not de jure, but de facto. And there was, in fact, an agreement signed way back. Now, as far as air defense systems is concerned and major theater operations, Israel will never act on its own. It will act in terms of piecemeal military attacks, bombings, and so on. But ultimately, Israel is integrated into the U.S.-NATO structure. And historically, the United States has always used Israel as an outpost in the Middle East. We recall during the Bush administration that Dick Cheney intimated that maybe Israel would attack Iran on our behalf. In other words, he actually intimated they will do the dirty work for us. But in effect, an attack on Iran cannot take place without the green light from the Pentagon. I think that we're in a very dangerous crossroads in our history because there's an evolving situation in the Middle East. There's a shift in alliances. There's a global military agenda. Let's bear in mind that since 2001, we have had a whole sequence of military operations, some of them conducted by U.S. allies, but invariably, Washington has been behind the wars in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and so on, and of course Ukraine. So that essentially what is unfolding in 2019, in fact it has been unfolding for a long period of time, is a global military agenda. It's the globalization of war. And coupled with this are military plans to attack Russia and China with nuclear weapons. I mention this because these military plans are in the public domain. You can go and read them. The RAND Corporation has actually published its own plan a few years back, and more recently we have another plan to that effect. So that all this is, of course, coalescing, and it's coupled with trade wars, financial warfare, sanctions. The nature of warfare has certainly progressed since the 1970s and 80s. And we have non-conventional forms of warfare. Some people call it hybrid warfare, where you destabilize a country by undermining its financial structure. That's what's happening in Venezuela. You simply manipulate the foreign exchange market, and then the Venezuelan bolivar collapses, triggering hyperinflation. That is something which has been on the drawing board of U.S. foreign policy for years. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that there is a global military agenda. And, of course, in addition to the wars in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, you have U.S. war plans against China and Russia.
In your article, Wipe the Soviet Union Off the Map, you write that on March 1st, 2018, President Vladimir Putin unveiled an array of advanced military technologies in response to renewed U.S. threats to wipe the Russian Federation off the map, as contained in Trump's 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. What does Trump's 2018 Nuclear Posture Review say?
The 2018 Nuclear Posture Review is really a red herring because it doesn't say anything different from the 2001 Nuclear Posture Review. And I know that a whole series of interpretations have come up on that 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. It simply reasserts the notion that this new generation of nuclear weapons, low yield, more usable, is what is being put forth. Now, what we must, of course, address is the fact that going back to the Obama administration, there is currently a $1.2 trillion nuclear weapons production program. Okay? In other words, that is money going to the defense contractors. And obviously, these are the lobby groups. They get the money. Now, they're getting the money for producing something which, first of all, the development of this new generation of nuclear weapons was actually decided at a secret meeting on Hiroshima Day. I believe it was in 2003. The Pentagon and the private sector got together, and it was the private sector, it was the defense contractors, which designed a new program of nuclear weapons technology, which would essentially feed their pockets. It was profit-driven. And distinct from the Russian program, which was a very carefully designed air defense system to avoid the first strike, they said, well, no, the first strike won't work anymore. The whole initiative going back to the Reagan period with Star Wars and so on was to enact a weapon system which would enable knocking down Russia or China with a first strike without the danger of any kind of response from the enemy. And Putin has said, no, this you can't do. you're stuck. The weapons industry are not really concerned about that issue because they're getting the $1.2 trillion. And Obama bears a heavy responsibility for having endorsed this program, but Trump has sort of pushed it up to 1.2. It used to be 1 trillion, now it's 1.2 trillion. Bear in mind, the defense budget, which was recently approved by the U.S. Congress, is of the order of $750 billion a year. It is a very large percentage of federal tax revenues, which goes to building the war economy. And inevitably building the war economy is one of the main sources, not the only one, of the collapse of bridges and roads and hospitals and schools and the whole impetus to privatize everything which was public. They don't have money. The U.S. public purse does not have the resources to fund those civilian projects. And that is, of course, the guns and butter relationship, which is the key of your program. There's nothing left for butter. And that is something, of course, that we have to address. The empire is undermining the republic. And that's something which Julius Caesar understood. You don't build an empire with a republic. But the republic is dead. And the devastation which is now occurring, the poverty in the United States, is in large part, not exclusively, in large part the result of the shift between butter towards guns. In other words, the development of a whole military apparatus, not to mention the militarization of justice and law enforcement and so on. Now, just a few years ago, and I think this is very important, just to give you a little bit the feeling of what happens behind closed doors, but which is really known and documented. The RAND Corporation, on contract with the U.S. Army, the RAND Corporation is a sort of semi-government independent research entity which acts on behalf of a U.S. government entity. In this case, it was a U.S. Army which commissioned a report examining a war with China. This is called War with China, Thinking Through the Unthinkable. The irony of this is that what they want to examine in this report is whether we could actually win a war on China. Okay? And the conclusions are, and I'll read a small segment, conflict could be decided by domestic, political, international, and economic factors, all of which would favor the United States in a long, severe war against China. Then they say, although a war would harm both economies, damage to China's would be far worse. Because much of the Western Pacific would become a war zone, China's trade with the region and the rest of the world would decline substantially. And third, China's loss of seaborne energy supplies would be especially damaging. A long conflict could expose China to internal political divisions. And then, of course, Japan's increased military activity in the region could have a considerable influence on military operations. Essentially, this is a simulation of a war between the United States and China and comes up with the conclusion that we're going to win it. That's diabolical and it's criminal. What has China done to the sovereignty of the United States? It's a hegemonic project to go in and blow up China. Now, I say this, but at the same time, more recently, there's been another project which has been put forth, which consists in waging a war against Russia and China, and which is currently being discussed by the U.S. Congress. The United States is saying, yes, we have plans to wage war on these two countries. And this is known and documented. Nobody in the media will actually say, well, we shouldn't do it. And nobody in the media will actually put forth an examination of what this kind of agenda would imply if it were carried out. And it's, of course, it's tied into Russiagate, it's tied into the trade war with China, and so on.
Well, what then is your view of 2019?
2019 will have several countervailing processes. On the one hand, there is a protest movement developing in Western Europe with the Yellow Vests. Now, my assessment is that that movement will be effective in as much as it also becomes an anti-war movement, a movement against NATO, because the impoverishment and the high levels of unemployment in the European Union are largely due to the militarization of their respective economies. Military spending is taking a big chunk of the public purse on the one hand, and then you have the neoliberal agenda. But a meaningful movement will have to integrate. It has to address these deadly macroeconomic reforms, which trigger poverty on the one hand, and it has to address the fact that neoliberalism and the global war economy are intricately related, and that neoliberalism creates the basis for funding the so-called defense industry. That movement, I think, is certainly gaining impetus. How will it unfold? And I think we have to think in terms of grassroots movements worldwide. And we have to think of grassroots movements within the armed forces. It is a violation of the U.S. Constitution to fight illegal wars. That is the oath that members of the armed forces take when they start. I think within the armed forces, there has to be also a concurrent movement from the grassroots up and through the governmental intelligence establishment. We're not going to reverse the tide simply by having people protesting. And anti-war sentiment will not undermine this military agenda. All the sectors of society will have to join in and understand that a $1.2 trillion nuclear weapons program is ultimately the source of potential destruction leading to the unthinkable, which is the destruction of humanity. That has to be understood, but how that grassroots movement will develop under present conditions is very uncertain because people don't have that understanding. At the same time, as we know, all these NGOs are funded by corporate foundations. We have color revolutions. Dissent is funded and it's manufactured. And we have divisions within the left. We have segments of the left which are supporting the wars in Syria and so on. And the question is, how do we build a mass movement to undermine this imperial agenda, which is also generating poverty and despair throughout the world, but also in the core of the empire, namely the United States of America and, of course, Western Europe, Canada, and so on.
The online news outlet BuzzFeed on Thursday published a damning expose on Trump, saying that he instructed his former attorney and fixer Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about his plans for a Trump Tower in Moscow, and that Trump also supported a plan set up by Cohen to visit Russia during the presidential campaign in order to personally meet President Vladimir Putin and jumpstart the tower negotiations. All of this was happening apparently while Trump was telling the public that he had no business deals in Russia. After Cohen was in the crosshairs of the special counsel's investigation, BuzzFeed reports that, quote, the president personally instructed him to lie by claiming that negotiations ended months earlier than they actually did in order to obscure Trump's involvement. The Washington Post said BuzzFeed's Michael Cohen story, if true, looks to be the most damning to date for Trump. CNN asserted that, quote, this may be the smoking gun in the Russia investigation. The BuzzFeed report came on the same day that the Wall Street Journal reported that Cohen hired a technology firm during the Trump presidential campaign to try to rig online polls in favor of Trump. Cohen confirmed the report on Twitter. We turn to Paul Seamus Ryan. He is the Vice President of Policy and Litigation at Common Cause. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
It seems as though every new bombshell that drops feels to us like this is the one that's going to be the straw that breaks the congressional camel's back, if you will, and push them over the edge into impeaching this president. How significant is first the BuzzFeed article?
Before commenting on the BuzzFeed article, I want to mention that it is not a huge surprise that Congress, under Republican control for the first 2 years of the Trump presidency, didn't do anything, did not exercise its obligation of oversight. But it's a new day here in Washington, D.C., with a new democratically controlled Congress, so we might see some action. The BuzzFeed piece that was published on Thursday, really, if true, and I want to underscore that because it's anonymously sourced, but if the allegations in that report are true, it exposes Trump himself to multiple federal crimes. There are a couple of federal criminal statutes that prohibit causing someone else to break the law, as well as what is known as suborning perjury or inducing someone else to commit perjury. And there's also obstruction of justice on the table as possible criminal violations by Trump, in addition to criminal violations you already mentioned in the intro, the possibility of impeachment and obstruction of justice, of course, as well as lying to Congress, causing others to lie to Congress. Those are all impeachable offenses. So this is a pretty big deal.
The president's defense when it comes to anything Cohen has claimed has often been to say, well, he was the lawyer. He was the one who knew whether there were laws being broken or not. I'm the client. I just told him what I wanted him to do. He should have advised me on the legalities of my requests. But this has sort of been the gist of how the president has claimed a defense against anything Cohen says he did.
It's a pretty weak defense. And, you know, I think that defense for some individuals might carry a little more weight when it comes, for example, to the campaign finance crimes that Michael Cohen committed, pleaded guilty to, and has implicated Trump in the commission of. For some individuals, they might be able to credibly argue, I don't understand those laws. Trump doesn't really have that excuse for a couple of reasons, but perhaps first and foremost that he and Michael Cohen were the subject of a Federal Election Commission investigation back in the 2012 presidential cycle for very similar alleged violations, illegal in-kind contributions when Trump was exploring a possible 2012 candidacy. So Trump has some familiarity with these laws. He was subjected to them. He hired a lawyer to defend him against allegations of wrongdoing years ago. When it comes to lying to Congress, no one with a straight face, I think, can credibly claim that they didn't know it was illegal to lie under oath to Congress. So the argument that, oh, my lawyer should have told me that I shouldn't be telling my lawyer to lie to Congress, that's an absurd defense argument, in my opinion.
Now, the sources in question in the BuzzFeed article are two federal law enforcement officials involved in an investigation of the matter. So even though they are anonymous, this identification of them as federal law enforcement officials is pretty damning. I mean, BuzzFeed would be breaking every journalistic rule if indeed they misstated who their sources really were. That goes pretty far up. Additionally, it shows that Trump just lied in his assertions to the public. He kept saying he had no business dealings in Russia at the same time that Cohen was giving him and his children, who are also in the government, at least Ivanka, updates on a real estate development in Russia. So is that also something that should inform Congress, especially the House, when they restart impeachment proceedings?
Yeah, it should definitely inform Congress. And I think it's also worth mentioning that although Michael Cohen's credibility is a bit shaky, the sources that spoke to BuzzFeed indicated that Mueller's investigative team, they are not solely relying on Cohen saying that Trump told him to do this, but the Mueller investigation team also apparently has other independent evidence. They have documents, emails from the Trump organization, other witnesses that all support Cohen's alleged claim to the Mueller team that Trump told him to lie to Congress. So there are Cohen's statements to Mueller. There's also independent evidence in the possession of Mueller that supports Cohen's statements.
Coming out on the same day as the BuzzFeed article, also involving Cohen and Trump, this particular piece asserted that, and this is not an anonymous source, I understand that this was a man named John Gouger, who worked for a company, a technology firm, and who told the Wall Street Journal that he had a $50,000 job to rig online polls in favor of Trump, and that Michael Cohen paid him cash. He didn't get fully paid, but this was the reason for this, and Cohen confirmed this on Twitter. You mentioned that there were several crimes that were possibly committed here as well.
This $50,000 reimbursement to Michael Cohen, it's been an issue of interest to me going back to August, because when Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to two campaign finance crimes and six other financial related crimes back in August, the charging documents from the Department of Justice mentioned this $50,000 reimbursement to Michael Cohen from the Trump Organization, but he wasn't charged with anything related to that $50,000 payment. So I've been wondering for months what this $50,000 in so-called tech services reimbursement to Cohen was all about, and wondering why he wasn't charged for any violations related to it. And the Wall Street Journal piece Thursday gives us more information. It paints a clearer picture of what was going on there. There were three different types of tech services that were allegedly provided to Michael Cohen by this individual, two of which, in my view, don't fall within federal campaign finance law. They weren't really at all closely tied to the election itself. So one of those tech services was setting up a Twitter account for Michael Cohen. And the name of the Twitter handle is women for Cohen. And the whole purpose of this was to fluff Michael Cohen's reputation publicly as a sex symbol and just bizarre, something really odd, slimy sort of behavior.
Wow.
That one's just weird, and I don't think it has any nexus to the presidential election. It's just connected to Cohen's own ego. The second matter was rigging a poll that was taken in January of 2014. So this is more than a year before Trump even became a candidate for the presidency. And it was about U.S. business leaders. And I don't think there is a close enough nexus of that sort of poll, rigging that type of poll, to the election for it to fall within the campaign finance laws. But the third one was the rigging of another poll. And this was a poll that was taken in February of 2015. And that was about the election. And even though Donald Trump had not yet declared his candidacy, he was clearly, in campaign finance law speak, he was testing the waters of a campaign at that point. So the contribution limits apply. So I think it's that second of two polls that was rigged, the third of the three items that Cohen was supposed to have paid for, that falls within the scope of campaign finance laws. But things get pretty tricky from there when trying to figure out, okay, what was the actual amount of the violation? Because Cohen only paid this guy a little under $13,000, apparently a Walmart bag stuffed with cash, and he threw in a boxing glove from a professional fighter as, I guess, something of value. So just another bizarre angle on all of this. Instead of paying the guy $50,000, as originally agreed upon, he paid him under $13,000. But when trying to analyze what was the amount of a campaign finance law violation, it would be the amount that Cohen paid someone to do tech services to influence the election without reporting this as a contribution to the Trump campaign, without the Trump campaign disclosing it. So it would be some fraction of the 13 grand, a third maybe, spitballing it. So we're talking in dollar amounts, pretty small. And all of this is a pretty complicated story. I've been rambling on for 5 minutes or so explaining these tech services and why they might violate campaign finance law. And all of this, really, the bottom line adds up for me to making it pretty clear that the Department of Justice probably just didn't want to muddy the waters of the Cohen prosecution. They had two really clear, easy to explain, much larger violations, the hush payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. We're talking in grand total in the neighborhood of $300,000 in violations. Easy to explain. And then you have this other really weird, only partially compensated tech services, some connected to the election, some not. I think that's why they didn't charge Cohen for the tech services that were at the center of the news story in the Wall Street Journal.
Can all of this that has been revealed be the smoking gun that some people are saying Mueller needed in order to really justify some kind of indictment against the president? I mean, collusion is that word that keeps popping up.
Certainly could be. And there is a vigorous debate among constitutional law scholars and criminal lawyers about whether a sitting president can even be indicted, can be prosecuted while in office. So setting aside that complicated legal question or issue, it is certainly the case that if Donald Trump were not to be reelected in 2020, there could be criminal charges waiting for him in January of 2021. So this is true of the campaign finance crimes, the payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, which Michael Cohen says he did at the direction of Donald Trump. That means Donald Trump broke the law, if that's true. Those indictments could be waiting for Trump in 2021 if he were to leave office then. So even setting aside prosecution while in office, all of these crimes, all of these indictments, prosecutions could be waiting for Trump in 2021 if he's not reelected. And then, of course, you have the possibility of impeachment that would begin in the U.S. House of Representatives, probably with what is called an inquiry of impeachment resolution. That would start an investigation and then lead to articles of impeachment. And if the House passed those, it would go on to a trial in the Senate. So there are a few different ways this could go. A lot of legal jeopardy, a lot of exposure to criminal prosecution and or impeachment for Donald Trump. What isn't getting much discussion is something that a guy named Ryan Goodman, a national security expert, pointed out on his blog, Just Security, in a piece today, which is that because Russia was involved in all of this, this is really a national security issue as well. This isn't just about the president lying or the president having someone else lie under oath. If, in fact, the president had Michael Cohen lie under oath, the president and any one of his team members who were involved in orchestrating these lies to Congress exposed themselves to blackmail by Russia. That's what makes this a national security crisis. That's what makes this a much bigger deal and a worse matter than was the Watergate scandal that had some similar obstruction of justice issues at play. This is a national security issue because the president and others in his inner circle who were involved in these lies by Cohen to Congress, they would be exposed to blackmail by Russia for having made these lies.
Does Trump's current lawyer, Rudy Giuliani's spewing of contradictory nonsense on television, play into any legal issues here? Recently, Giuliani was essentially admitting when asked about collusion not being a crime. He used to say collusion isn't a crime. Now he said, I never said there was no collusion with Russia, implying that there was collusion. Do Giuliani's words implicate the president legally?
One of the things I've been saying about Giuliani for a few months now is with defense lawyers like Giuliani, who needs prosecutors?
Right.
Because he's been sticking his foot in his mouth for months now. You know, I've been really closely following the campaign finance crimes that occurred in 2016 by Team Trump because I filed complaints with the DOJ. Common Cause filed complaints with the DOJ in January, February, and March about these hush payments. And Giuliani was the one who revealed to the world that Donald Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen. That's what put Donald Trump on the hook for criminal violations in that matter. And again, as you've mentioned, he's done it again now, you know, with his commentary about initially denying there was any collusion and now saying, I never said there was no collusion, admitting that there may have been collusion, but Donald Trump wasn't personally involved. That's a disaster for Team Trump. I can't believe they're still allowing him to get on camera and speak on Team Trump's behalf.
And then the other questionable move that Trump might be expected to take to end this shutdown that some have said could also be impeachable because it might be unconstitutional is this idea that he could use the justification of a national emergency to fund his border wall and thereby end the shutdown. And that might mean reappropriating funds that Congress has already allocated to help disaster zones hit by hurricanes and wildfires from recovering. If he does go through with this, is this something that you're also going to be deeply concerned about?
Definitely. And Trump has on several occasions over the past few weeks walked up to the line of declaring a national emergency and then took a couple steps back away from that line last week. It's a concern. There would undoubtedly be a legal battle in courts if he were to do it. The legal battle would be whether or not there was a close enough fit between what he claims to be a national emergency and the statutes he points to that justify certain presidential actions in certain national emergency situations. So he could make the declaration and then he would undoubtedly be sued immediately and have to defend his actions in court. I think he'd have a hard time doing that.
And then finally, Paul, Michael Cohen is set to testify in front of Congress in early February. There was some question whether he would or not, but then on Twitter on Friday, he did assert that he would be testifying. He retweeted David Corn, journalist, saying that Representative Elijah Cummings announced that Cohen will publicly testify February 7th, and there's much to ask him beyond the hush money payments. Cohen can also discuss Trump dealings in Russia and reaching out to Putin office and so much more. Buckle up, said David Corn, and Michael Cohen retweeted that. These hearings are likely to be quite explosive, aren't they?
I'm going to be popping some popcorn. I think we should expect that a portion of these hearings will not be open to the public, and that's understandable given that some aspects of his testimony could relate to national security concerns, could relate to Mueller's ongoing investigation, but I have no doubt that the testimony will be interesting and there'll be some more bombshells in there.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Paul, for joining us today. Give out the website for Common Cause where people can look into some of the work that your organization has done on these issues that we've been talking about.
We're at www.commoncause.org, been around for about almost 50 years, nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog organization holding power accountable.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Before we start the meeting, I have an announcement.
Out of order. Announcements happen after roll call.
Roll call happens before announcements.
Can I go now?
Baron?
Present.
Baron is here. Melania?
Why am I here?
Present. Ivanka?
present but not voting.
Ivanka is here. Swing voter?
I have a question and an announcement.
Swing voter is present. What is your question?
Who's keeping time?
I volunteer to be timekeeper.
Baron is keeping time. You have 17 seconds.
I have an announcement. Well, it's an observation, not an announcement. I have been a subscriber for many years.
Time's up, dude.
I have more to say.
Time's up. This meeting is over.
Out of order.
Oh,
yeah. Come on. Baron, are you trying to sabotage everything?
I don't really care, dude.
This has got to stop.
Hey, the meeting's not over until the facilitator says it's over. Siri, who is facilitating this meeting?
The facilitator has been detained for questioning. 12 seconds.
I would like to nominate myself as the new facilitator.
Do you have a hidden agenda?
I misplaced my hidden agenda. Can I borrow yours?
Nominations for candidates running for open seats on the local station board must be submitted before the nomination deadline can be extended.
Vote for me!
What qualifies you to save this radio network from bankruptcy?
Well, I need the work, and the benefits are great.
Are you willing to work with the program committee?
Rescue the program committee!
Rescue the program committee!
The program committee was disbanded by a secret cell of saboteurs working undercover to limit dissent.
Do you think so?
After I purchase this network, you can be executive director of the programming committee.
Why me? I don't know anything about programming.
You're hired.
What do I do?
Study this top secret manual.
The U.S. government field manual of simple sabotage.
Where did you find this?
General Mattis, we got hammered.
We are talking with members of the First Family about government program to promote simple sabotage.
But why?
Baron, memorize the index.
Why?
General Mattis, I'm seeing him tonight.
Ivanka, the U.S. Army field manual for sabotage is above top secret.
Can I see? Is that an update?
It's classified, Baron. Authorized officers only.
Dude, I'm smarter than General Mattis.
Baron has genius level IQ. 148.
What does it say?
Sabotage without detection or reprisal is the goal.
I need an example.
Caller on line 2.
Go ahead, caller.
A potential saboteur can make bad decisions to waste time and divide public comment.
Why do you want to divide public comment?
To evade detection, limit your public statements to cryptic memes with double meanings. Do you understand?
I really don't care. Do you?
Excellent. I don't care. Rocks.
Melania's jacket could mean anything.
But it's confusing.
Confusion is a feature, not a bug.
But, Melania, what does I really don't care really mean?
It means they've changed the narrative.
Donald wants a messy divorce after he's reelected.
Unless somebody on the inside commits an act of sabotage.
Oh, my, Baron. Do you have some issues?
We all have issues. The clones are waking up.
Even if the stars and moon collide, I don't want him back in my life. Maybe I should have known he would walk. You can take your words and all your lies. I really don't care. I really don't care.
Don't care. I really don't care. I really don't care. Oh, oh, oh.
song is I Really Don't Care by Demi Lovato. I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is Twit Wit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. We are talking with Baron and Ivanka about mental illness in the first family. Also, here is Baron's private tuner, General Mattis.
I can't stay long.
What are you teaching, Baron?
Baron? Right now I'm learning about gene replacement therapy for inbred royal families.
Weaponized gene replacement therapy is being weaponized right under our stupid clown noses.
The bloodline families are invincible.
I would like to be descended from Cleopatra. Is that possible?
Are you a traitor to your country or to your class?
I'm obsessed with the royal family.
That's disgusting.
Now, family connections are just medical procedures.
Big Pharma can do anything.
The food, the drugs, the health.
The Agent Orange.
No liability.
Liability for what?
Violent and suicidal ideation.
When I was on those drugs, I was irritable and mean, but I'm better now.
How did you quit?
Bionomics.
Roll the clip.
If I had been asked to speak at a conference in San Francisco called the Bionomics Conference, and I said, what is this cockamamie bionomics? And I started to search and hunt, and I stumbled across it. By 1900, a special discipline existed at Indiana only for elite students handpicked by the college president who had created and taught the course. It was called Bionomics, and it dealt with the why and how of producing a new evolutionary ruling class. Did Bionomics have any effect on life in the state of Indiana, where so many sons of prominent Indiana families had studied the arguments for controlled breeding and elimination of the unfit? And its practice there became the law of the land. 20 years later, in the trial of the German doctors at Nuremberg after the Second World War, the Nazi physicians testified that their precedents were importantly American ones, and that their name for forced sterilization had been the Indiana procedure. In 1922, Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, demanded severe restrictions on public debate, as the Lippmann's words. In light of the enormous number of feeble-minded Americans, said Lippmann, the old ideal of participatory democracy is insane. Let us strike to the heart of this thing, then, and take back our children from the management engineers. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The voice is anarchist educator John Taylor Gatto, and now, back to our story.
I have your medical records.
Why am I here?
Are you wearing perfume?
So what?
It's my new fragrance. Brute Stench. The fragrance of man-boy billionaires.
The entire first family is a sick and twisted deception operation.
Exactly.
You know, sick and twisted is the new mental health. Are these your medical records?
Let me see that.
This show host has ODD. Oppositional Defiant Disorder.
These are my confidential medical records.
Cool, dude.
Privacy is a bug in the system.
How would you like everyone to know about your condition?
That's fine. I have submissive obedience syndrome.
Submissive personalities are highly valued in society.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker.
I want a revolution.
You can rebel, Baron, but you must be compliant.
Has there ever been a compliant rebellion?
MoveOn.org.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion passes.
Who counted the votes?
John Taylor Gatto on line one.
Go ahead, caller.
Mathematically segregating kids according to the alchemy of standardized test scores, committing the worst mistake of all, yoking the world of work to the world of schooling, forcing a connection which simply does not exist. And when we come to transcend our Columbines, it will be because we awaken from this self-induced nightmare and act out of two bedrock principles. One, that nobody can educate you except yourself. Surely our universal individual experiences confirm that one. And two, that over-organization precipitates entropy, the disintegration of order. It's a direct byproduct of overorganization. That's a principle of thermodynamics, which translated into everyday life means simply that craziness increases in closed systems shut off from the outside. It is not a recent phenomenon. Inmates in schools have been shooting each other to express their hatred of these places. By conditioning children to what is instead of what could be, it heavily subsidized existing commerce by indoctrinating children in what is and how to succeed with what is. Schools became large institutional analogs to factories. School is training for work or is training to be a consumer, but never an independent producer. It requires top-down management.
John Taylor Gatto talking about bankruptcy and compulsory schooling.
Voluntary bankruptcy is a scam.
Yes, and it's perfectly legal.
Well, voluntary bankruptcy is an attack on free speech.
Ivanka has the floor.
Baron is studying to become a bankruptcy attorney.
You're broke, dude.
General Mattis on line two.
Ivanka, retract that statement.
Never raise your voice at me in front of the children.
It can consent can never be voted down.
I'll consider it. Who gets my urine sample?
Medical experiments on human livestock is nothing new.
Baron, we are in danger here.
I love you, Mother.
Oh, some tea?
Thank you. We must go.
Don't drink it.
Ivanka, truth serum has no effect on me. I was vaccinated.
Was I vaccinated?
Vaccinations are for little people.
Do I have damaged chromosomes?
Most royal families have them.
Do royal family clones pass on their damaged chromosomes to future generations?
I might have a twin.
I don't believe it.
Ask my wicked stepsister, Ivanka.
Hey. A toast to the death of Big Daddy.
To the death of Big Daddy.
When you receive orders, they come from me. When you are caught, you will confess. You will never know more about the underground. Are there any questions?
Do congenital liars run in families?
Which families?
We have to stop him, or we will never be free.
The clones are waking up.
Is it that obvious?
It's so obvious.
After you leave, memorize everything in this book and burn it.
The official U.S. government manual for simple sabotage.
I don't trust it. It might be a setup.
Page 666, selecting a facilitator.
I knew it. The facilitator.
facilitator on line two.
Go ahead, caller.
I have been facilitating secret meetings since I was a script assistant at the Rand Corporation. We're a fun group. There's nothing to see here. Can I see a show of hands? Okay. Okay, and how many aren't sure? You all want the same thing.
What do I want?
You want to cash out now while you have a positive cash flow.
And now, back to our story.
I have your medical records.
Why am I here?
Why are you wearing perfume?
My wicked stepsister.
It's my new fragrance, Brute Stench, the fragrance of manboy billionaires.
You know, it stinks. Your entire family is a biological dead end. You have no empathy genes. Psychopaths and sociopaths have no capacity for empathy.
I really don't care. Do you?
What do you care about, dear?
Clones are people, too.
Are you all clones?
It's just a gig.
Are these your medical records?
Let me see that.
You have ODD, oppositional defiant disorder.
Again, these are my confidential medical records.
Cool, dude.
Privacy, dude.
I told you, privacy is a bug in the system.
Steve Bannon is my birth father.
How did you discover that?
I never let him kiss me. I really don't care. Do you?
Oh, sometimes I'm a swing voter. I have submissive obedience syndrome.
Submissive personalities are highly valued in society.
Really?
But you won't rebel until you're conscious.
Why not?
Do you expect a compliant rebellion?
Well, I do. I want a compliant rebellion. The wine and cheese and a lovely massage.
Is that a motion?
Second.
You can't second your own motion.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
The motion fails.
Who counted the votes?
What is a conduct disorder?
I might have that. What can I take for it?
Take my word for it.
Or take a vacation.
Consider having a steamy affair with a porn star.
Was that your idea?
To get him off my back.
Why are you admitting this?
Because you put truth serum in the tea.
It's just show business.
Show business is real. Elections are fake.
Really?
How deluded are you?
Well, I'm a swing voter.
You like being deluded.
I'm hooked on this stuff. I mean, I was at the parade and I saw some really fine delusions.
Can you be more specific?
I'd rather not, but okay. I saw a wiener dog wearing a dildo. I mean, I saw a naked woman on a scooter, and those scooters are illegal. And then we were all singing, "We're all a family under one sky. Just a family under one sky." Who knew?
What are you saying?
Well, on Klonopin, I can be dangerously calm in an emergency.
But the side effects are great. You will love them.
Delusions are a drug.
I took half.
A half delusion?
Maybe I need the other half.
Would you settle for some false hope?
Do you have any?
I have a tweet here that says non-commercial radio is trending.
Why now?
Oh, the proles are waking up.
The proles and the clones together.
Is that what you believe?
Me? Oh. Well, I believe that commercials are bad, but public service announcements, they're not all that great either.
I have one.
Go ahead.
A man in Scotland was arrested for teaching a dog to perform a Nazi salute.
Arrested?
For teaching his dog to perform a Nazi salute?
What happened to the dog?
The dog got off scot-free.
Scot-free is an ethnic slur. The scotch I drink is very expensive.
Scot-free is an insult to rich white people who don't pay taxes.
My ancestors owned Scotland, dude.
Can I see the receipt?
Ivanka, show him the receipt for Scotland.
The bank has it.
The bank owns Scotland, not you.
And who owns the bank?
I own everything, dude.
I own half of everything.
It's going to be a messy divorce.
Who gets custody of Baron?
Donald has Baron on alternate weekends.
My father is teaching me everything he knows.
There is more to life than drawing a big crowd, but not much more.
I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is Twit Wit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. Before we go to round three, are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
Everyone has a chance to have a full and prosperous life.
That's not an announcement. That's an aspiration.
No, it is not. It is a trick. I don't want a chance. I want a guaranteed basic income.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
And I want it now.
Me too.
Can you be more specific?
I can't retire until I'm 97.
You must be very productive.
Well, thank you. I am. I was, but not anymore. People are afraid to be detained for laughing at my jokes.
Is that supposed to be funny?
Is anyone laughing?
Maybe the audience is laughing on the inside.
Laughing on the inside throws off my timing.
That's... I've got the giggles.
Laughing on the inside is a suspicious activity.
I'm getting very angry about this.
What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to burn my voter registration card.
Why didn't you retire sooner?
I can't afford to buy myself a gold watch.
Is that all you want?
No, I want universal health care.
Fat chance.
Everyone deserves a fat chance to have a prosperous life.
I want more than that. I want to be a traitor to my class.
Baron, if you become a traitor to your class, the president will disown you, and the Pentagon will disable your internal navigation system.
I can't believe I live in a world like this.
Are the clones waking up?
I have to make a confession.
You signed a non-disclosure agreement, General Mattis. You cannot confess to anything.
I did not have sex with that man.
Me? General Mattis. I'm falling in love with you.
Keep it to yourself.
I'll try, but will you have me?
That's a gotcha question, and I don't answer gotcha questions.
Will you endorse my candidacy for president someday?
I'm running for first woman president as a Democrat.
But aren't you a Republican?
Whatever. Does it matter?
I understand what you mean. I like the way the Republicans abuse me better than how the Democrats abuse me. Well, the choice is yours alone.
The little people are waking up.
Waking up is okay, but please, no more acting up.
Anyone who acts up will be shot.
Can't we fire them and get some new little people?
Well, that's a clever idea. Yes, let's do it.
General Mattis, we have been over this.
I know, but I can't find my notes.
I call the question.
Oh, yes. All in favor?
No.
The motion fails for lack of a second.
Victory is ours.
Oh.
This is the Berkeley Signal. Truth isn't truth.
I never worked for Russia.
Last week, we learned that back in 2014, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, hired a tech firm to rig a CNBC poll, rating top business leaders in Trump's favor. Not only did it not work, Trump didn't make the list, but there's this reporting in the Wall Street Journal. Quote, Mr. Cohen called CNBC and threatened that Mr. Trump would sue over his poor standing in the ranking, arguing that the news channel was ignoring the will of the people. People familiar with the matter said. CNBC didn't respond to the threat, and Mr. Trump didn't sue. Tim, this is a story so full of all the idiocy of the times in which we live.
Even when they try to rig a poll, they can't get a majority of Americans to that Donald Trump is a great businessman.
But it's all corrupt. I mean, they don't play anything straight.
Well, from then, you know, this is early 2015. This is before he's even declared his candidacy, and they try to rig two polls. One is Donald Trump a great businessman? They fail. Another one is a Drudge poll that Trump should be one of the leading early contenders for the Republican nomination. That doesn't work either. And Trump's so irked that finagling doesn't work. And by the way, they paid for this in cash, stuffed
like
in a Walmart bag at Trump Tower. Still didn't work. He then turns around and sues them for not following through on his rigged efforts with his poll.
Literally nothing is on the up and up. Nothing.
No, nothing. The guy Cohen hired to do this, according to the Journal, showed up at Trump Tower looking for $50,000 he was owed. And when he did, the report says Cohen gave him a Walmart bag with $12,000 to $13,000 in cash and a boxing glove he claimed had been worn by a Brazilian MMA fighter as payment. It's like a scene out of the world's dumbest heist movie. So Cohen also asked the guy, while he was doing this, to set up a Twitter account called Women for Cohen. This is a real account. It was created back in 2016. It's for, quote, women who love and support Michael Cohen. Strong, pit bull, sex symbol, no nonsense. Basically, Cohen asked this guy, help me rig the election. Hey, while you're at it, could you make people think girls like me, too?
And now, it's time for Deal or No Deal, government shutdown edition. With your host, Howie Mandel.
All right, now, government's been shut down for like a month, and I spent 2 hours at TSA yesterday in Atlanta. They thought I was smuggling extra teeth in my mouth. So let's bring out the guy who said he would own the shutdown. He's the president, and we both got neckties long enough that they could get caught in the Roomba. Please welcome Donald Trump.
Hey, Steve, tremendous to be here, just tremendous.
Okay, now, earlier today, you went on TV, and you told the American people that you want to make a deal.
That's right, Steve.
All right, so we decided to do this in the only format that you can understand, a TV game show with women holding briefcases. All right, now, in your briefcase here, you got the deal that Congress offered you in December.
And I said, no deal.
Yeah, nobody's excited about that, player. What was your counteroffer today?
I want $5 billion for my border wall, and in exchange, I'll extend DACA, and I'll release the kids from cages so they can be free-range kids.
Okay, well, let's see the members of Congress that are willing to offer you new deals so this nonsense can go away. All right, what do you say, Mr. President?
Five.
You want to open briefcase number five?
No, I'm saying a lot of these women are fives.
On the day of the Women's March.
Okay, then I choose case number three, Fancy Nancy Palooser. I'm still working on a nickname.
That's a great start there, player. Okay, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Nancy, how you feeling tonight?
Just normal, not like drunk on my own power or anything.
Okay. Now, you rejected the president's offer this afternoon.
I'm afraid I did, which is a real shame because I hate saying no to you, Mr. Trump.
Yeah. Okay, I'm scared. Let's just see what's in your briefcase, Nancy.
Okay. $1 billion and you say Nancy's my mommy.
Okay. $1 billion for the border security. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, but it's not $5 billion, and I need $5 billion because that's the first random number I said. No deal.
Oh, no. We're still fighting, Mr. Trump.
My God, you almost gave me a heart attack.
I'm so sorry, Mr. President. If the government's shut down, you can't do the State of the Union. It's for security reasons, not because I'm vindictive or anything.
I can't do the State of the Union. And guess what? You're not flying to Afghanistan.
Oh, no. I can't go on my vacation to a war zone. What will I do?
Boy, this is like watching... It's like watching two grandparents fight over the thermostat. All right, Nancy, you had your chance. Donnie, let's pick another one, please.
I'll take that older Jewish woman on case four.
Okay, that's Chuck Schumer.
That's okay. I'm just happy for any attention, yeah.
Okay, Chuck, show us your offer.
Okay, my offer is... whatever you want.
No, Chuck, we're not doing that anymore. Remember, we're not caving in.
Oh, right. Yeah, projecting strength. Okay, let me put on my fiery red cheetahs. Okay, my new offer is $15 and a pastrami on rye, you know.
Okay, deal or no deal, Mr. President. And remember, every time you choose no deal, 500,000 federal employees work another day without getting paid.
Cool story, bro. No deal.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of getting paid, I need to thank our sponsors tonight. Green beef. Yeah, it shouldn't be green, but ain't nobody at the FDA to inspect it. And old lady in an inner tube way out in the ocean. Yeah, the Coast Guard will be back soon. Hang in there, Beth. All right, let's pick again, player.
I sure will, player.
Hey, it don't work both ways. I ain't Kanye.
I'll go with case 9, Steve.
Okay, that's Playboy Mitch McConnell. No, Mitch, you can't just disappear in the middle of this. Come on out of there. Poke your head back out of that shell. We got a nice, juicy little piece of lettuce for you. Well, he's not going to be much help, Mr. President. I got to ask you, who are you playing for tonight?
I'm playing for a little charity called Habitat for Hannity. It helps Sean Hannity get a second beach house.
Oh, man, let's just pick another number.
Okay, who's on case 8? Is that Cardi B?
No player. That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
That's okay, Steve. Trump and the GOP are just terrified of me because I'm under 100 and I know how to use Instagram. I mean, just look at Mitch McConnell. He's already bird boxing.
I can hear the girl. Stay away.
All right, you know what? Why don't we just open 3 cases real quick and get this over with? Cory Booker.
Booker 2020.
Oh, my God, not another one. Congressman Steve King from Iowa.
Wines.
Well, at least the guy's consistent. All right, wait a second. This time it is Cardi B.
I know this ain't my business, but shmoney.
Okay, you know what? This government gonna be shut down for like a year. Let's take a quick break.
No, wait. I want to open that case from the Clemson football player.
Okay, that's not a briefcase. That is a Crave case from White Castle.
Well, I'd still like to have him open it, Steve.
Oh, my God. Okay, fine. Open the case, please.
Hamburgers.
Yeah. Oh, Steve, I haven't eaten a hamburger in almost 15 minutes. I'm going to make that deal.
Wait, you ending the shutdown for a hamburger? Well, I guess that makes as much sense as anything else that's going on these days.
In Russian news, the big story is... anybody's guess.
The president appears to be on a collusion course with the law right now. His alleged lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, was back on CNN last night.
The president's lawyer went on TV and basically admitted that his campaign might have colluded with Russia. And it really does seem like the pressure of the job is getting to Rudy because last night he went on CNN and blurted out another one of his trademark accidental confessions. Rudy was interviewed by CNN's Chris Cuomo, and the way these two yelled at each other was like watching two guys play cards in the back of a butcher shop.
They hated Trump.
hates
your word, but clearly
no.
Like
when you say that a
the
man
inspector
is a,
general,
when
two
you
of
say
them
that a
said
man,
it didn't affect their work. I wouldn't want to be investigated
fair?
By anybody, and it was the right move to remove them.
By
no,
the
they
time
didn't.
They were finished.
They wanted
yes,
to.
They did. They don't pay any attention. To
I
the
was
platform.
Raised by a guy who would have corrected the punctuation
well,
Chris, protocols. I'm saying that that was.
Let me explain.
Guy who was at the head of the AG at the time.
I'm hyperactive about the probe, Chris. Let's be truthful. Let's be truthful, Donna. Come on now.
Always.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
And that was all. That was like. That was like not even a minute into it. Rudy starts every interview like he's an hour five of a police interrogation. I want to welcome our next guest, Rudy Giuliani. You got me. I'll tell you everything you want to know. And then Cuomo asked Rudy about the latest bombshell in the Russia investigation. Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, shared political polling data with a business associate tied to Russian intelligence. And that's when Rudy made a stunning claim. He never said the campaign didn't collude with Russia. Just that Trump himself didn't collude with Russia.
Now you have Paul Manafort giving poll data up leading to this coincidence.
Well, you just misstated my position. I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes, you
have. I
have
no idea if I have not. I said the President of the United States. He said he didn't. He didn't say nobody. How would you know that nobody in your campaign?
He actually did say that, Rudy. He said nobody, and then he said as far as I know.
He said that, he said it in a... Well, as far as he knows, that's true.
Look at him. Even he looks surprised by what he just said. Either that, or he's got a binder clip behind his head pulling back all of his skin.
But there must be another Rudy Giuliani out there who's been going around saying there was no collusion between Russia and the campaign.
Is it still the position of you and your client that there was no collusion with the Russians whatsoever on behalf of the Trump campaign?
Correct.
Russian collusion. Here's what they found. Zero. Nada. Nothing.
If anything, it's proof there was no collusion. Nobody talked about Russians. Nobody knew about Russians. There was no collusion with the Russians. No collusion with the Russians. There was no collusion.
There was no Russian collusion. No Russian collusion. Case over.
Was there collusion? Come on. Nobody believes anymore there was collusion.
Start on July 7th, 2017 in Hamburg, Germany, the G20 summit, the site of the first face-to-face meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. That morning, you may recall, the New York Times reached out to the White House for comment on a story about Donald Trump Jr. and senior campaign officials meeting with Russians during the campaign in Trump Tower here in New York. Remember this timing as we look at how events unfolded in Germany, because around the same time in Hamburg, in the afternoon, President Trump and his then Secretary of State met with Vladimir Putin and the Russian foreign minister for more than 2 hours. Now, after that meeting, the president confiscated his interpreter's notes, giving an order not to reveal what was discussed in that private meeting. That is information that we now know thanks to the Washington Post and its reporting. Well, later that evening, the president sought out Putin, meeting privately with him and the Russian government interpreter without any other Americans present. Video of the event shows the president gesturing towards Putin during that dinner. You see it there, waving his hand in an apparent, you know, you and me kind of motion, pumping his fist, something we've all seen when the president does rallies or when he's on tarmacs with his supporters. Now, the very next day aboard Air Force One, the president reportedly dictated his son's misleading response to the Times' reporting. Don Jr. said at the meeting, they, quote, primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children. All right, so days later, the Times obtained emails between Trump Jr. and a British publicist setting up the meeting, an exchange that offered dirt on Hillary Clinton, to which Don Jr. said, if it's what you say, I love it. Okay, more than a week later, the New York Times interviewed the president himself and was asked about the mystery meeting between Trump and Putin back in Germany. The president said, quote, it was not a long conversation, but it was, you know, could be 15 minutes, just talked about things. Actually, it was very interesting. We talked about adoption. All right, so the president then even tried to brush aside concern about that Trump Tower meeting, saying, quote, I think most politicians, I was just with a lot of people. They said, who wouldn't have taken a meeting like that?
Think about how much their argument has changed. It went from there were no contacts with Russians to there was no collusion with Russians to we tried to collude but nothing came of it to collusion is not a crime to there was collusion but it didn't involve Trump. If this keeps going, Rudy is going to be telling Trump, it's not jail, it's a gated community. We don't know exactly what Trump's level of involvement was in collusion, but we do know that as a politician and president, Trump has always admired Russian President Vladimir Putin and sought to emulate him. Even before he ran for president, he was desperate to be Putin's friend.
Do you have a relationship with Vladimir Putin, a conversational relationship?
I do have a relationship. I spoke indirectly and directly with President Putin, who could not have been nicer.
I was in Moscow a couple of months ago. I owned the Miss Universe pageant. And they treated me so great. Putin even sent me a present. Beautiful present with a beautiful note.
It was a beautiful note, handwritten, and it was delivered by a raven in the middle of the night. Just tapped. His beak tapped, and that woke me up.
And we also know that Trump has had all kinds of business entanglements with Russians and Putin in particular, including the fact that as late as the summer of 2016, he was in talks with Putin to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. He was even going to entice Putin by giving him an apartment in the building.
One of the ideas for that Trump building, according to one of his business associates, was to give the top floor, the penthouse apartment in a 250-apartment block, to Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, as a way of attracting buyers.
Well, it's our understanding that they went on throughout 2016. Weren't a lot of them, but there were conversations. Can't be sure of the exact dates, but the president can remember having conversations with him about it.
Throughout 2016.
The president also remembered. Yeah, probably up to, could be up to as far as October, November. Our answers cover until the election. So anytime during that period, they could have talked about it.
After he did that interview, Rudy went even further than that in an interview with the New York Times where he quoted Donald Trump as saying, quote, the Trump Tower Moscow discussions were going on from the day I announced to the day I won. Rudy's latest comments stand in such stark contrast to the president's previous version of that story that Rudy had to spend the day today trying to clean it up, telling NBC News just in the last hour, quote, my recent statements were hypothetical, not based on conversations I had with the president. My comments did not represent the actual timing or circumstances of any such discussions, to which Kellyanne Conway's husband, George, tweeted in a reply, translation, I just make bleep up. If Rudy's having a hard time keeping his facts straight, it may be because the party line on Trump's business with Russia has shifted 180 degrees since the start of the campaign, beginning with Trump's claim that he had nothing to do with Russia at all.
I mean, I have nothing to do with Russia. I don't have any jobs in Russia. I'm all over the world, but we're not involved in Russia.
We could make deals in Russia very easily if we wanted to. I just don't want to because I think that would be a conflict.
It was a well-known project. It was during the early part of 16, and I guess even before that.
Could be up to as far as October, November. Our answers cover until the election. So anytime during that period, they could have talked about it.
It'd be funny if it wasn't so scary. Even the possibility that Trump could have been pursuing business in Russia throughout the campaign stands out against a backdrop of Russia-friendly policy pronouncements that we now know contributed to the suspicions that the FBI had about whether Donald Trump might actually be working for Russia, suspicions that led them to take the extraordinary step of opening a counterintelligence investigation into the president in the early months of his presidency. But before they even got to that point, during the campaign, the president made these, at the time, bizarre statements while pursuing a business deal with Russia. He called for an end to economic sanctions against Russia, the one imposed by the Obama administration. He gave interviews in which he questioned the legitimacy of NATO. And he called on Russia to release hacked Democratic emails that Mr. Putin's government was rumored at the time to have stolen. What does it all mean for the Mueller probe? And what does it mean that someone sent Rudy out today to clean up the cleanup of his clarification?
There was no collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian people.
I have nothing to do with Russia, folks.
I have nothing to do with Russia. I don't have any jobs in Russia. I'm all over the world, but we're not involved in Russia.
They said maybe Donald Trump is involved in projects with the Russian. The answer is no.
Zero. I mean, I will tell you right now, zero. I have nothing to do with Russia. I have nothing to do with Russia.
We know that Donald Trump has been parroting, puppeting, not just Soviet talking points, not just Russian talking, Putin's talking points on the invasion in Afghanistan. We know that Donald Trump had the desire and spoke of his desire to destroy and withdraw from NATO. We know that Donald Trump disparaged and disagreed with and disbelieved his own intelligence community when it came to the Russian meddling in the 2016 election. We know that Donald Trump, from your colleague Greg Miller's reporting, destroyed all the evidence, all the notes of his five meetings with Vladimir Putin. And we know that Donald Trump was more comfortable talking to Vladimir Putin with a Russian translator present, not the American translator. All unprecedented. What do we not know? What's the remaining mystery?
May I say to you that the problem of racial injustice is not limited to any one nation. We know now that this is a problem spreading all over the globe. Right here in London and right here in England. You know so well that thousands and thousands of colored people are migrating here from many, many lands. The West Indies, from Pakistan, from India, from Africa. They have the just right to come to this great land. They have the just right to expect justice and democracy in this land. England must be eternally vigilant. But if not, the same kind of ghettos will develop that we have in the Harlems of the United States. The same problems of injustice, the same problems of inequality in jobs will develop. And so I say to you that the challenge before every citizen of goodwill of this nation is to go all out to make democracy a reality for everybody, so that everybody in this land will be able to live together, that all men will be able to live together as brothers. You know, there are certain words in every academic discipline that soon becomes stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical vocabulary. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in modern psychology. It is the word maladjustment. You've heard that word. This is the ringing cry of modern child psychology. And certainly we all want to live well-adjusted lives in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I must say to you this evening, my friends, as I come to a close, there are some things in my own nation, there are some things in the world which I'm proud to be maladjusted, which I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation, discrimination, colonialism, and these particular forces. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I must say to you tonight that I never intend to become adjusted to the madness of militarism, the self-defeating effects of physical violence. But in a day when Sputniks and explorers are dashing through outer space, and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. The alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation. And I assure you that I will never adjust to the madness of militarism. You see, it may well be that our whole world is in need at this time for a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women, men and women who will be as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." Maladjusted as the late Abraham Lincoln, the great president of our nation, who had the vision to see that the United States could not survive half slave and half free. Maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, could etch across the pages of history words lifted to cosmic proportions. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say to the men and women of his day, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." Through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the long and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. May I say to you that I still believe that mankind will rise up to the occasion in spite of the darkness of the hour, in spite of the difficulties of the moment, in spite of these days of emotional tension when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail. I still have faith in the future. And I still believe that we can build this society of brotherhood, this society of peace. We have a song that we sing in our movement. We've joined hands to sing it so often, beyond, behind jail bars. I can remember times that we've been in jail cells made for 12 people, yet you would find some 15 or 20 there. Yet we could go on and lift our voices and sing it. I mentioned it yesterday afternoon as I was preaching at St. Paul's. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Somehow I believe that mankind will overcome. I believe that the forces of evil will be defeated. I believe this because Carlyle is right, no lie can live forever. I believe that we shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right, truth crushed earth will rise again. I believe that we shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. With this faith, we will be able to adjourn the councils of despair, bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. With this faith, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace and brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, Hindus and Muslims, theists and atheists, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." We have a long, long way to go before this problem is solved. But thank God we've made strides. We've come a long, long way. I close by quoting the words of an old Negro slave preacher who didn't quite have his grammar and diction right, but who uttered words of great symbolic profundity. "Lord, we ain't what we want to be. We ain't what we ought to be. We ain't what we gonna be. But thank God, we ain't what we want."
This is the Berkeley Signal.